Eric Pallas's new book is called Ballot Bandits, but the book title itself is Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. So thanks for listening. Opinions of those of the speakers. Labor Hour is at hand.
Thank you. Hello, folks. Welcome to the June 9th, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois, and streamed worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming, those of the speaker, do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WFT's manager, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call area code 217-328-2295. That's 328-2295. And this hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us later in the show. The Labor Hour Cultural Corner, Tom's poem for this week is one from his book, Cries for Justice, and is entitled, I Am Freedom. Also here with us today is Pat Simpson. Now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
Last month, the National Association for Business Economics announced that its latest survey of economists found rising expectations for job gains and housing construction. And in April, the Federal Reserve raised its forecast for growth this year to nearly 2.7% from a January estimate of 2.5%. However, it now looks as if the recovery is stumbling again. Faced with a decreasing jobs market, many economists have turned more pessimistic and no longer think that U.S. economic growth will accelerate later this year. According to a recent jobs report, employers added only 69,000 jobs in May, the fewest in a year. The government also reported far fewer jobs were added in the previous 2 months than were expected, 11,000 fewer in March and 38,000 fewer in April. And the unemployment rate rose from 8.1% to 8.2%, the first increase since last June. Less hiring, of course, means fewer Americans have money to spend. That holds down consumer spending, which drives about 70% of the economy and helps fuel job growth. A rising unemployment rate tends to reduce confidence, and that further diminishes spending. Other reports are showing that more people are seeking unemployment benefits, another sign that hiring could remain sluggish. Pat?
Yes, and unfortunately, President Obama made that mistake this week of saying the private sector looks fine. Of course, Romney jumped on immediately. This is a story datelined 5/27/12. It's also kind of the good news part of the news program. I'm sure we'll be getting to some of the bad news in a moment. NLRB's Flynn resigns. Terrence Flynn, National Labor Relations Board member, resigned yesterday evening, effective July 24th. He has immediately recused himself from all agency business and has asked that the president withdraw his nomination for board member of the NLRB. The NLRB Inspector General earlier this year issued two reports describing how Flynn funneled confidential information about NLRB activities and deliberations, including attorney-client privileged information, to two former NLRB members who have worked to undermine and discredit the board. One of those former members was Peter Schomburg, who co-chaired the Labor Policy Advisory Group for Mitt Romney's campaign. The inspector general found additional instances when Flynn funneled confidential information to Schomburg. These included a draft of an NLRB decision, dissents before cases had been decided, and other information on the NLRB's internal operations. Flynn was sworn in as a member, board member, on January 9th, 2012. He joined the board in 2003 as chief counsel to Schomburg and had previously been in private practice. There also are some investigations going into a violation of the Hatch Act because public employees, public federal employees, are not supposed to be disclosing confidential information.
You know, it's amazing. I'm just going to be curious to see if this guy gets any jail time, if any. I mean, compared to the harassment that legitimate whistleblowers have gotten, including Private First Class Bradley Manning.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, on the international scene, the year 2011 was a difficult and often dangerous time for workers throughout the world. Those who dared to stand up for their trade union rights often faced dismissal, arrest, imprisonment, and even death. That, in essence, is a picture that engages from an annual survey of union violations published by the International Trade Union Confederation. The study examines 143 countries throughout the world. Colombia is once again the most dangerous country in the world for trade unions. Didn't they just pass a free trade pact with Colombia? Gee.
Yes.
And they said that everything was fine and that those things don't happen anymore.
All in the past.
Yes, right. Anyway, there was some 79 people murdered in Colombia just last year for their trade union activities, not counting workers killed during last spring. 29 lost their lives just in last spring in Colombia. In Guatemala, yet again, trade unions paid a heavy price with 10 murders committed with immunity. And 8 trade unions were murdered in Asia. The worldwide trends highlighted in the survey include the non-respective labor legislation by governments, the lack of funding for labor inspections and worker protections, the lack and abuse faced by migrant workers throughout the world, particularly in the Gulf of Arabia and the Arabic countries, and the exploitation of the largely female workforce and the export processing zones around the globe, including Haiti. And among the most vulnerable are the 100 million domestic workers worldwide. Tom?
In the United States Senate last Tuesday, Republicans blocked a Democratic bill calling for equal pay in the workplace. There seems to be some heavy-duty rivalry in Washington over the Paycheck Fairness Act, a measure that aims to strengthen the Fair Labor Standards Act's protections against pay inequities based on gender. The legislation, sponsored by Democratic Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, would require employers to prove that differences in pay levels are based on individual qualifications, such as education and other bona fide abilities not related to gender. As was pretty much expected, the pay equity bill failed along party lines by a vote of 52-47, short of the required 60-vote majority required. For the Democrats, passage was not the only point. The debate itself was aimed at putting Republicans on the defensive on yet another women's issue, this one overtly economic, after reports showing slower than expected job growth. President Obama said in a statement after the vote, "It is incredibly disappointing that in this make-or-break moment for the middle class, Senate Republicans put partisan politics ahead of American women and their families." Pat?
Thanks, Tom. This is a brief story. Headlined, "Got Inequality? Need Unions?" Lots about inequality in the news in recent days, especially with the release of Tib Noah's book on the topic, The Great Divergence. Yet one key reason often left out in analyses of the nation's rising inequality is the decline of union density. Correcting that omission, the Economic Policy Institute hammers home the point that up into the 1970s, labor unions both sustained prosperity and ensured it was shared. And critically, union bargaining power has been shown to moderate the compensation of executives at unionized firms. Points out that NOAA concludes, if liberals really want to reverse income inequality, they should think seriously about rejoining labor's side, EPI President Larry Michel asserts. I would add that such a revival is necessary to rebuild the middle class and to preserve our democracy. Hear, hear.
Yes, indeed. France's new socialist government is set to restore the right to retire at 60 to about 100,000 workers, a symbolic partial reversal of one of the measures of the previous president, Nicolas Sarkozy. was most proud of. The cabinet meeting on June 15th is to restore the right to retire on full pension at 60 to people who started work at 18 and have paid contributions for 41 years. The decision should come into effect within 3 weeks. The move was a key promise of Francois Hollande's election campaign. Although his failure to reverse the whole measure disappointed many trade unionists and left-wingers, this is a step towards forward socially, after all, commented Francois Charquet, the leader of the reformist CFDT Trade Union Federation. Sarkozy's imposition of retirement at 62, which also limited the pension rights of millions of workers who had not paid contributions for long enough, sparked union protests, but was welcomed by business and pro-austerity economists.
Well, it's been in many ways a sad week for labor. We came in this morning and Paul asked us why we were all dressed in black. And indeed, I think it's pretty easy to understand that what happened in Wisconsin puts us all in a, shall we say, dismal mood. I'd like to see us also take up the topic of what happened in Wisconsin at greater length, and David and I and Tom have been discussing that this morning, so we may devote a whole program to this soon. But let me go with it. Wisconsin results could inspire more attacks on unions. This is out of Milwaukee. Wisconsin Republican Governor Scott Walker's recall election victory and the vote of two California cities to curb the pensions of city workers may embolden political leaders across the country to take on labor unions, experts said Wednesday. Walker survived a recall election Tuesday forced by liberal critics opposed to his bold moves to limit the powers of public sector unions in a state that could be a battleground in the presidential election. Then voters in two of California's biggest cities, San Diego and San Jose, on Tuesday overwhelmingly supported cutting pensions of city government workers to save money. This is a watershed moment, a historic moment, said Gary Chasen, professor of labor relations at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. They, meaning the unions, gambled heavily and they lost heavily. It's a real problem for them, Chasen added. There's been a series of analyses of what went on, perhaps prematurely at this point. Obviously, one of the things that's been talked about is that a lot of money that was, the enormous amount of money that was pumped in, particularly on the part of the Republicans. But others have pointed out that actually the money didn't seem to sway voters that much, that in point of fact, early on when they did surveys, they discovered that in fact, voters were going to vote in a certain pattern, in a certain way, and they continued to maintain that pattern throughout. What perhaps is most disturbing is, one, 38% of union households essentially voted for Walker. Raises some real interesting questions about what's going on out there. The other thing I think that's important, though, is to understand any recall election is an uphill battle. 60% of Wisconsin voters said they didn't necessarily like the policy decisions of Walker, but they thought it was a bad idea to recall someone on the basis of a policy decision. So that is a problem right there. Then the other thing, and I'm sure David would want to take this up too, is this larger question of, was it appropriate to even push all of this mass mobilization and the energy behind it into a recall election at all? And again, this is a debate that's been open. Many people are saying it should have, there should have been a more prolonged direct action campaigns of some sort, et cetera. And again, this might be something we want to take up in more detail later on.
Yeah, indeed. And there's some other interesting things, too. I mean, first of all, the Walker people, they started campaigning almost a year ago before this election. And what the main focus and message that they had was, recall election's a bad idea. I mean, that was their almost their sole message. And it seemed to work. I mean, and what's also interesting is this guy who ran as mayor of Milwaukee. I mean, I saw him giving a concession speech. I mean, this guy was lame. I mean, he even got booed by the crowd when he said, well, I called and congratulated Governor Walker and told him that we're going to be willing to work together and stuff. And everybody, is supporters, booed him. You know, it's like, this is the guy that they ran against Walker? You know, I mean, first of all, I mean, I found out that this guy, I can't remember his name, but he's anti-union himself. You know, he beat out a really good candidate in the primary, a woman from Madison, actually. I think she was a city council person or county board person. And basically, the Democratic National Committee threw all this money to make sure that she didn't get elected and that he did instead. Well, guess what happened during the actual general election here? The Republican National Committee pulled out all the stops. I mean, money, resources, staffers. Democratic National Committee gave the Wisconsin Democratic Party a couple thousand dollars for getting out the vote. And President Obama didn't go anywhere. He avoided the state of Wisconsin like the plague, never mentioned it. Oh, but he did send a tweet on Election Day hoping them the best of luck. Now, there's something wrong with this picture, folks. I mean, definitely. I mean, this is, you know, there's an interesting little post from Doug Henwood, who does the Left Business report that Paul
Left Moore. Business Observer. And if you would have been listening to the previous program, News from Neptune, you would have heard him talk about this. And I did read the article or the blog, and I agree with him wholeheartedly. But I want to go further. I don't really care about these Democrats and stuff. Mm-hmm. What this is about is the idea that is obvious now that, number one, electoral politics in the United States is not democracy. All right? They had elections in the Soviet Union. Okay?
But you had a one-party state?
Yes, but we have a one-party state, the capitalist party state. All right? Well, at least they didn't try and fake it, you know? But the whole point is, this is not about morality. This is not about fairness. This is not about democracy. This is about power. And
who controls that power?
That's right. And the Democrats want to control that power, and the union leaders want to control that power. So they don't want the membership, or perhaps not even non-union workers, to know that they are the actual power. And they want to continue on in the tradition of the old AF of L, which was allowed to exist so that they could have more control over workers. You know, that's like these public workers. How did they get these rights? They got them through wildcat strikes, you see? And these governments, like in the early 20th century, late 19th century, they decided that they would rather deal with an organization than with a bunch of workers that might go off the job at any time. For example, there's friends of mine who are members of one of the local building trades unions who were prosecuted by that union last year for walking off of a job.
He was prosecuted?
Yes. And I know him and probably all the rest of them had to pay a $1,200 fine for walking off a job because they felt that the work rules were not being obeyed. Their craft jurisdiction was being impinged on. And the union charged them and fined them.
So basically the union is acting as an enforcer for the contractor's benefit.
Yeah, well, it's a channel for the energy that, you know, might go off. But I think one of the reasons unions are allowed to decline is that the PR and marketing techniques and political science applications have made them redundant, that the American workers don't need to be controlled that much anymore because they'll just take what is given.
You know, Doug Henwood goes on to say, suppose instead the unions had supported a popular campaign instead of a recall election, that is, media, door knocking, phone calling to educate, and organize on the importance of the labor movement to the maintenance of living standards for all workers. If they had made an argument broadly and repeatedly that Walker's agenda was an attack on the wages and benefits of the majority of the population, that it was designed to remove organized opposition to the power of right-wing money in politics, that would have been more fruitful than this major defeat. I mean, I have to tend to agree with that. What do you think, Pat?
Well, I agree, and also I think that there was another point brought up in a posting that I got from Waging Nonviolence, a website that's essentially associated with a guy by the name of George Lakey. And one of the things he pointed out was that if you go into electoral politics at this point at all, what happens is you focus your efforts on resources on very minor wins, wooing the undecided voter. And that's one of the reasons that they went away and moved away from the kinds of issues that you're talking about. By the end of it, Barrett wasn't even talking about collective bargaining and the taking away of collective bargaining. What he was talking about was, well, maybe Walker's a criminal. Right? And therefore, bad government is what he was talking about. And That, I think, is such an important point to understand the limits of electoral politics at this particular point in time. The other thing I just want to mention is that a lot of discussions going on right now about what kind of direct action campaigns do we have to start looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, for example, these mass mobilizations like we even saw and I participated in a couple of weeks ago, the anti-NATO, are not the ticket. That what we need are almost a flying squadron kind of approach.
Multiple flying squadrons.
Exactly, exactly. And again, we can talk more about that, the concept of affinity groups and the like. But electoral politics are just put you into a box, and it's a box, I think, that unfortunately too many leaders in the Democratic Party and in the labor movement want us to be in.
Yeah. Well, and another thing, too, you know, what are people thinking about between elections and what are they learning? Is one of the staffers at your union hall, an administrative assistant, sitting there telling you that she thinks that progressive taxes are unfair to rich people? You know,
well, again, we get back to the corporate media on this, that they broadcast their propaganda 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and working people consume this, you know, and they believe what they hear, you know, and it's just that, you know, it's like Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister, said, if you repeat a lie often enough by a government or, in this case, a corporate news media, then most people believe it eventually.
Well, I would strongly suggest that people go to works like Alex Carey's Taking the Risk Out of Democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Look at things like that. Number two, another one is The Century of the Self, a series of documentaries by the British producer Adam Curtis. And anyway, here's another take on this, and this is from an anarchism Reddit thing. I'm not really sure how.
Okay, Bill, could you hold that thought, because we got a caller calling in, and we got to get to the last poem here real quick. But please hold that thought, because we want to take this up on the last part of the hour, because this is really important. So, okay, Tom, we're now going to that section of the program, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas's poem for this week, "I Am Freedom."
I have no legs, yet still I dance, because it's what I need to do. With every breath I take a chance, it is the last and I'll be through. I have no wings, yet still I fly, soaring high in each human heart. Your need means I can never die, and never from your world part. I have no heart, yet still I love, no matter what they've done to me. My soul's alive, here and above, where some are saying I should be. I am the right to draw a breath and not to have it poison me, and so it should be unto death when all the universe is free. I am the long and open road to which so many dreams have come, to lighten up a bitter load by silencing war's throbbing drum. I am the tyrants driven out and punished for their evil crimes. I am that for which people shout to bring about some freer times. I am the property of all, even those few who are so dumb they cause my temporary fall. I will come back. I am freedom. I Am Freedom was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois in 2008 and was brought to you live today, June 9th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And just remember to tune in this Sunday and every Sunday to Labor's Worldview TV on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6. And for the next 4 weeks, we're going to be doing some of the classics from the first season. On this coming Sunday, it will be Harry Bridges and the ILWU about the West Coast Longshoremen. Very interesting history, great film footage. Then following week on the 17th will be Walter Reuther and the United Auto Workers. Also some great film footage from the 1930s when the United Auto Workers still was a very militant union. And then on June 24th, there'll be part one of the Staley lockout that occurred in Decatur, Illinois in the early 90s with the two short films Deadly Corn and Struggle in the Heartland. And on Sunday, July 1st, will be part two of the Staley lockout with special guest Mike Griffin from Decatur, who was one of the road warriors during that struggle. So, Pat, do you have something for our listeners?
Yes. Here's an announcement that says, join us for two great events, the healthcare movie screening and candidate meet and greet plus canvassing. For more info or RSVP, contact Kurt Bateman, And this healthcare movie screening is on Saturday, June 16th from 7 p.m. to 9. Healthcare is a basic human right recognized the world over and contained in the doctrine of every faith tradition. However, the crisis in healthcare is one of public understanding, not of capacity or financial sustainability. Come see the healthcare movie, 65 minutes of fact. Act documentary about how we got into this mess and the way forward to enhanced and expanded Medicare for All, single-payer healthcare. Where? Channing Murray Foundation, that's 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. There's on-street parking, but free parking in underground garage at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. I should also say that I know that actually on a Saturday there's free parking in the Channing Murray parking lot, which they don't mention here. View film, gain knowledge, get active, discussion with Dr. Gill supporters. For more info or RSVP, contact Kurt Bateman. And I'm sorry to say this is not really well put together because Mr. Bateman's contact information isn't here anywhere. But essentially, maybe you could go to the Gill campaign, Google that, and you might get some information.
You know what? I should have known better. I'll have to tell the listeners. I got rounded up at the. I was walking through the farmer's market this morning by some people I knew that were in the Democratic Party tent. Yes, some of my best friends are unfortunately are Democrats. I don't understand it, whether you still vote for him blindly. I mean, I can understand voting for a certain Democrat in a certain race here and there that deserves the support. But nevertheless, I was given this, and I thought, oh, okay, this is a good policy thing. I didn't read the whole thing, and there we go. It's a stump for the Gill campaign. But that's okay, because this is an important issue. And, you know, as long as they're trying to do the right thing, I'm going to be supportive. I'm sorry. I have to apologize. I didn't know that was a stump for the thing for the Gill campaign.
But we should tell them they need the contact information on their flyers.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. But nevertheless, it's still worthwhile probably going to.
By the way, Heritage Days is going on right now in beautiful Bemet.
Okay, and what happens at Heritage Days, Bill? Are you a speaker?
Well, no, I drove by the park, and I try to stay pretty anonymous out there.
Oh, that's too bad.
I drove by the park, and there was a whole bunch of vendors out there vending various probably terrible things to eat and gaudy handmade jewelry and such. And I think there's going to be some kind of 50-60s show, and probably cars and stuff going on at Bryant Cottage. Something called geocaching, which I'm not sure what that is, but maybe I'll just Google that. But anyway, Bemet Days, it's happening now.
Okay, did you say that back in the 60s or 50s, Walter Reuther from the United Auto Workers actually came to one of these the Bemet?
Well, actually, in 1956 was the centennial of Bemet, and there's a really interesting guy from Bemet whose name escapes me now, but somehow he was very good at getting in tight and sucking up to rich people. Otherwise, he was pretty much an unremarkable person. Uh-huh. And he would get all these like big foundation jobs and stuff like that. And I mean, this dude knew everybody. I have a book by C.G. Yoon called, I can't remember right now. But anyway, on the it says that book was due to conversations with this guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's the only book that I know of that Young kind of wrote about politics and issues. But anyway, this is just really a weird class thing. But anyway, at that celebration, there were some famous people there that he invited, mm-hmm. one of which was Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, okay.
That's very well known. That's big time, you know.
Yeah.
But another one that I discovered was Walter Reuther.
Okay.
Yeah.
From the United Auto Workers.
It's just weird.
You know, it's interesting.
This dude knew C.G. Yoon.
Carl Jung, the psychologist.
Yeah, uh-huh. Walter Reuther, and apparently at least Marilyn Monroe's agent or manager.
That's pretty fascinating for somebody from Bemet, you know. Walter Reuther, you know, fascinating person. I mean, you know, pretty much was in the ground struggle for the recognition of the United Auto Workers, the sit-down strikes and stuff. And then later years, he pulled the United Auto Workers out of the AFL-CIO in opposition to the Vietnam War. And not to get into conspiracy theories here, but shortly after he did that, him, his wife, and his daughter were killed in a mysterious plane accident.
Well, there's some, if you read the book, The Brothers Reuther, mm-hmm. by his brother Victor Reuther, mm-hmm. they were out and out socialists. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't mince words about it. In fact, Walter Reuther spent some time in the 1920s working for the Ford Company in Russia.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's going to be on this coming, not this Sunday, but the following Sunday. You can see some of that great footage from the 1930s of the Flint sit-down strike and stuff. Some fascinating, exciting footage from that era.
I always show that film in my labor history courses when I was teaching at Loyola, and I would have some MBA students in. And one of the things that was always a lot of fun was to say to them, I want you to watch this film, and you tell me if you're kind of surprised at the level of violence that you see here. And they were always in a state of shock. And it was the beginning of them being a little more open to maybe
there's
reasons
pretty,
for reason.
That's
for
pretty
unions.
Clever, Pat.
Well, I mean, or if you could show them the 1935 massacre.
Oh, the Memorial Day Massacre, yes.
And there, I saw a video from the 1990s at Century City with the SEIU, Justice for Janitors. And anyway, they're walking down the street, and there's this line of cops there, and these dudes look like the Aryan ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And the people get there, and they're on the sidewalks, but they have to get off the sidewalks because the cops are blocking them.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, the cops, you know, start going like this, and people turn, and they're beating people with billy clubs, and they had all the permits and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear this. You hear people screaming in this parking garage, and then the EMTs show up to clean up what their cop buddies did.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yes. Okay, we're going to listen to a little Jim Hightower, and we'll be right back.
The Koch boys are trying to buy Wisconsin. Hear about it today on Hightower Radio. Unless you hang out in posh watering holes with America's far-right billionaires, chances are that you don't know Diane Hendricks. But Scott Walker, Wisconsin's anti-middle-class union-whacking governor, knows her and loves her a lot. In fact, Scott loves Diane at least $500,000 worth. That's how much the heiress to ABC Supply, the nation's largest roofing and siding wholesaler, has put down so far on Walker's desperate effort to avoid being only the third governor in U.S. history to lose a recall election. His day of reckoning is tomorrow, and his last bastion of support is a phalanx of union-hating out-of-state billionaires like Hendricks and the infamous Koch brothers, who've erected a multimillion-dollar wall of money around him. We've spent a lot of money in Wisconsin, deadpan David Koch of New York City. We've gotten pretty good at this over the years, he boasted of his extremist political attack machine, adding that we're going to spend more. As of last week, Scott had amassed $30 million from friends like David, a sum comparable to what Mitt Romney's campaign raised to win the GOP presidential nomination. Such Koch cronies as the DeVos family, founders of the Amway marketing empire, chipped in $250,000 for the right-wing's nationwide Save Scott campaign. And Foster Freeze, the evangelical billionaire who dumped a ton of cash on Rick Santorum's theocratic run for the presidency this year, is in for $100,000. This is Jim Hightower saying, there's an old rule in business. If you don't have any sense behind you, pour in dollars. From the Edsel to New Coke, and now to Scott Walker, the strategy has been to overcome all product defaults with PR cash. Tomorrow, we'll see what Koch cash can buy. And if it buys the governorship of Wisconsin, look out where you live.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly...
Do we need... J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and the other Wall Street behemoths that dominate American banking? Who needs them? After enduring years of insatiable greed by the slick-fingered hucksters who run these gambling houses, after watching in dismay as their ineptness and avarice drain more than $19 trillion from America's household wealth since 2007 and plunged our real economy into financial crisis, after seeing them get trillions of dollars in taxpayer bailouts to save their banks and their jobs, and now, after learning that they've returned to paying multimillion dollar bonuses to themselves, we have to ask, huh? Oh, no, no, cry the banking titans. Don't even think of looking behind the curtain. Trust us, for we are essential to juicing the economy with our complex abracadabra investment schemes. In fact, however, those schemes just move money around, siphoning real investment capital from the grassroots up to super-rich global profiteers. Shell games at carnival sideshows are more honest than big bank trading houses, for the hustles of J.P. Morgan, Goldman, BOA, etc. are based on financial illusions, off-the-books accounting, illegally leveraged borrowing, ridiculous tax subsidies, and hide-the-pea secrecy. This is Jim Hightower saying, the obvious truth is that these high-flying, high-tech, high-speed emporiums of high finance serve themselves, not us. So we have no obligation or need to keep serving them. Of course we need banks to lend to us consumers and our productive businesses, to handle our commercial transactions, to manage our savings and provide financial advice, etc. But that's not what the Leviathans of Wall Street do. So, rather than protecting them, let's decentralize America's capital, reinvesting our public trust in community banks and credit unions that actually serve it and deserve it.
I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Okay, that was Tom Morello doing the old labor version song, Which Side Are You On? Okay, Pat, you had an announcement for the listeners?
Yeah, I want to apologize. We had scheduled to have Dave Foster, the executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance, on today, and due to technical difficulties, we haven't been able to make a connection. So I'm going to work on rescheduling, and when I find out what a good day for him to speak is, we will let you folks know.
Okay, now let's take up where we left off. Bill, you were talking, and I can't remember exactly where we left off, but I want to take up to where that was.
Okay, this is on Reddit, which I'm not very familiar with at all, but it's like apparently some kind of place where people just post stuff, all right? And this is headline, Scott Walker's win is our win. How we move our left statist friends towards anarchism. Okay, and this was submitted 2 days ago by Fuzzy Toe. I do not believe in God or supernaturally ordained circumstances, but if there were one to give us anarchists relevant current evidence of how unfair and wrong a capitalist statist system is, it would be Scott Walker winning his recall election. Has she gone mad, you might ask? No. I am not happy that Scott Walker won the election, but I am not surprised, and you should not be either. The election result is not a matter of Citizens United, changing everything, or even of the Democrats failing to appeal to the supposed morality of the working class. This election, as well as the Citizens United decision, as well as the utter uselessness of the Democratic Party, are just symptoms of the main problem, the belief that the only purported means of power working class people have in the United States is through the system currently in place. This recall election brought out so many people, enraged and bitter people, frothing with righteous energy that was expunged on a futile gesture. Not only was Walker not defeated, now every Republican governor has a pass to emulate him. What if that energy had been put into making something new? People are afraid of quitting. When you quit your job, you risk financial security. When you quit a game, you deign yourself the loser, or even worse, a, quote, quitter. And the only things we are ever told to quit are abominable. Quit bugging me, etc. But everyone has a limit. When that financial security seems to be rarely there to begin with, we quit or strike. When someone is cheating, we have no chance of winning. Quitting is dignified. We have been told the election system is our means to power. But now we have a very clear example that it is not. So tell your friends that the other people playing their game are not only cheating, they wrote the rules so that they would always win. And that is the only logical thing to do is to quit.
Well, that's an interesting comment, Pat. What do you think?
Well, I think it's quite interesting. I have to say that I don't know that I'm ready to abandon all electoral politics, particularly, I think, at the local level at this stage. But I do think that it is increasingly obvious that the electoral system is rigged against any kind of real progressive social change, and it is essentially largely in the hands of a corporate elite and becoming more so as we speak. And I, too, am moving more in a direction of support, as I mentioned earlier, for direct action campaigns. I mean, I think it's as American history will show us again and again, we only have to go back to the civil rights movement and various other movements before that. You don't get much in terms of real important change unless you get out on the streets. The question, I think, is how do we get out on the streets? And I think there have been some really interesting discussions recently, again, as I mentioned, about maybe mass mobilization is no longer the way, that we have to start looking at affinity groups. Actually, I will say, and I know that there's some people who've been critical of the 99% spring, particularly the training that David experienced recently. But actually, what has been interesting is that as a result of that training, Jobs with Justice posted a news item that indicated that essentially they trained more than 100,000 people, and already they've shown up at shareholder meetings confronting WellPoint, Walmart, Sallie Mae, Verizon, Bank of America. The shareholder season saw a record number of resolutions introduced by the shareholders themselves to cut CEO pay. And essentially, there just is more and more of this confrontation at a local level and at a strategic targets in mind. And I think that more and more that's the kind of thing we have to look at. And again, direct action doesn't always have to even be civil disobedience, but I think we certainly have to take that into consideration also.
That's some good information. I'm glad to hear that. You know, I always try to, I never want to, I'm not an absolutist. I mean, I'm a carpenter by profession. I have a toolbox with many tools in it, and some jobs require certain tools and not others, you know, but doesn't mean I throw away the tool just because it doesn't work on any particular job. And, you know, I look at elections that way. I mean, but, you know, the big problem is corporate money. I mean, let's face it, folks. I mean, corporate money is controlling both political parties. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Since the year 2000, unions have given over $700 million to the Democratic Party. That's three-quarters of $1 billion almost. $45 million of it just this year alone. And what do they got to show for it? You know, imagine if they'd spent that sort of money, say, you know, lobbying for single payer day in and day out, or, you know, other issues that benefit everyone. I mean, it would be a tremendous gain for the whole society, and not to mention good public relations for the unionism and the cause of unionism.
Well, Dave, I would go on to counter that. Well, I will probably vote, and there are people I know who will really dislike that idea. But I would also like to counter, though, in several ways, in that basically what we have here is not a battle for getting a particular political party or a particular politicians into particular offices. And while I do believe that there should be, we should still need to do that, and that the things that those people do really do count, and that there are some marginal differences, like I don't have to worry so much about the prevailing wage laws being taken away if I have Democrats. But I think like what you're saying about, you know, the use of resources, you know, I don't think it's the best use of my resources to spend my time doing a lot of campaigning for Democratic candidates.
Well, especially since, I mean, like this, you know, stat I just found out, I couldn't believe it, $750 million since 2000. And, I mean, what has labor got to show for it? I mean, I've been preaching this since 2000.
Yeah, but here's what I want to get into with you, Dave, and is that what I was talking about is what it is a cultural war. And George Lakoff, that Pat mentioned, you know, it's sort of, he sort of points that out. And there's all kinds of studies pointing out that people have different kinds of personalities, traits on right or left, and some possibility that they could be inborn tendencies. But I think the culture has a lot to do with it, and that is the tipping point. And that's why you have Earl Warren, who I believe was, if I'm not mistaken, was a fairly conservative person, had becoming the most liberal court in history, probably, with my limited knowledge of the history of the Supreme Court. And you have Richard Nixon going ahead and signing OSHA, signing the EPA, and such and so forth, because that was the tenor of that time.
The wind, that was the direction the wind was blowing, and who was making the wind.
I want to follow up on that, because I do think that this issue of culture is very important. And actually, David, just in his most recent comment, was focusing on the political system, but earlier he was also talking about the media. And I think the question becomes one of, to some extent, we have to deal with both. Maybe it gets to this many tools in the toolbox. I like that analogy. But on the cultural aspect, I think it's real important to emphasize what someone said in response also to Wisconsin, which is not just direct action, because we can have whatever type of direct actions we decide are the best kinds of direct actions, and hopefully decide in some participatory democratic fashion as opposed to, you know, top-down approaches to that. But also, I think what we need to do is think about education and, you know, an alternative, be it alternative media like we're talking about here. But most importantly, and this is the issue that you've talked about in the past, Bill, that we've talked about, and that is we got to get our out into the streets and start talking to those people, those 38% of union voters who voted for Walker have to start being reached. And we have to understand what are their motives. First, we have to get a clear sense of what their motives are, because really, who talks to those people anyway? And then we have to essentially offer them an alternative kind of perspective. But we got to get out and talk to those people.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the Henwood blog, that's his June 6th blog that's been under some discussion here, that's what he talks about, too. And that's what I mean. Good God, go out and knock on doors and educate people. And that's one way, definitely a direct way to help change this culture. And it helps let people know that they're not alone and that they're going to work every day and they're listening to all the racists and all the people who are sucking up to the bosses and everything else. And maybe they don't feel that way, but they think that that's the whole world.
Well, indeed, look what's on, you know, for corporate media entertainment. You got that show with Donald Trump. What's it called? The Apprentice, where it basically encourages people to backstab each other and all sorts of, I mean, basically, this is, you know, I had somebody tell me, well, if it wasn't, I said, I can't believe people watch this show, you know. You got these washed up celebrities bending over kissing Donald Trump's butt, you know, why his two worthless sons and daughter who couldn't get a job anywhere else are there acting like they're the, you know, the rulers of the universe. And then you got this show, what's it called, Hell's Kitchen, where you have these people working at a kitchen. This guy screams and yells at them. In fact, I even heard somebody committed suicide that would participate on that show, right? I mean, what does this all do? This is not by accident this is on. This is to encourage.
Well, it's not by accident that Rush Limbaugh got such a gigantic audience, because he was able to get sponsors to get on the radio stations to develop that audience. But something I wanted to ask. Think about this. Who do you think had more effect on the world? The Beatles or John F. Kennedy?
Well, that's a good one, Bill. I'd have to say the Beatles.
You know, I mean, you know, maybe they didn't beat out Jesus Christ. I don't know.
Imagine.
Yeah. Now, this goes all the way back to, you've discussed this on the show before, about that guy back in the 19-teens, this Bernay or whoever it was.
Oh yeah.
Well, yeah, and this is
about
major,
public relations.
Yeah, this is like
propaganda.
About half of the Adam Curtis Century of the Self documentary series that I earlier talked about. Was talking about. And basically, Edward Bernays was a double nephew of Sigmund Freud. He worked on the Creel Committee doing propaganda for World War I. And afterwards, he did much to develop what we call public relations, what Walter Lippmann and others previously called propaganda. And basically what this is using marketing and public relations techniques.
Plus psychology, though.
Yeah, I mean, he based him on Sigmund Freud, which I think is a fundamental error. But, you know, it's like the whole thing. If you broadcast something enough, you're going to get it across. But basically the idea is, and Alex Carey, the book I was reading called Taking the Risk Out of Democracy, is that the title describes it. What had happened was over the decades of existence of the United States, more and more groups got the right to vote. And what happened was people started voting their interest, and it was a risk to the ruling class. So when these techniques came along during and after World War I, they were seized upon by the establishment as a whole, the corporations, the government, and basically used to train us to be docile consumers.
What's that our friend Carl Estabrook says about the 20th century was the solid development of the advance of democracy, the growth and advance of corporate power, and the creation and advancement of public relations to protect corporate power from democracy.
Yes.
There's one other thing that I'd really like to throw in kind of this discussion of culture and kind of alternative discourse, I guess they would say. And that is also we have to deal with the issue of race. Because if you look at one of the things that Walker did, he ran negative ads against a Milwaukeean, that was Barrett, okay, were basically negative ads against the mayor's city, equating it with high unemployment, rising property tax, crime, and poverty. This is the tried and true GOP race card because everybody knows Milwaukee has a substantial population of dark-skinned
I wasn't aware of that. They're still doing that stuff.
They're still doing it, and yes. You know what? It works. It still works.
Yes. Okay, we're going to listen to another song by Tom Morello. It begins tonight, and then we're going to be listening to Occupy the Airwaves. And this has been the Only World Labor Hour on WFT 90.1 FM, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois, and live on the internet at WFT.org. So thank you for tuning in, and be safe this week, and power to the people. Take care.
Begins tonight on stage with borrowed angel's sword and a crossword puzzle of stolen chords. I'm alive, but those I love are gone. Let's move tonight and take the throne. Out go the lights. It begins tonight. Oh no. Thank you.